What I have found is so powerful with people when they are dealing with some kind of ailment or obstacle or challenge is when you can identify what the storyline is, what the thread is, what your internal sense of meaning behind that story is, and also feel and sense your body in separate ways, then you are able to reconstruct a narrative that feels better, that just simply feels better, that it doesn't hurt so much, that doesn't cause you so much strife or grief. And what I love about working with artists is that artists already know how to tell a good story.
Welcome to the Artist Becoming Podcast. Hey, Jess. Hey, Shelby. A 5, 6, 7, 8. Join us in weekly conversations with performing artists across stages, studios, rings, fields, and screens. Every conversation, a chance to dive deep into the story of their becoming. All right, Shelby, let's get on into it.
Hey, Jess.
Hey, Shelby.
We're back. Today's guest is Juliana Hazelwood. And of the many riches and pitfalls, I guess, of social media, one of the things that I love personally so much are just the relationships that we have been able to form through these platforms. And Juliana Hazelwood is one of them. She found us through our Artist Becoming community. And this woman is brilliant. Her passions and expertise are so incredibly aligned with the work that we are doing here. And it felt perfectly natural to sit down with her and have this conversation. Juliana has a intimate relationship with dance as an art form. She works as a mental health clinician and educator for teens and artists at the Joffrey Ballet School. And she's a gem. I loved speaking with her.
Juliana is a gem. Yeah, I think what's really special about this conversation is we've been really excited this season to blend together artists themselves and then experts outside of the stage realm. But Juliana is someone that has an incredibly intimate relationship to this work and is just such a lighthouse. She's a lighthouse. She's living and breathing this work. She's just extraordinarily passionate and curious about how we can better the dance world and better equip artists. And I know we both had quite a few light bulbs flashing during this conversation when we got into some topics around our nervous systems and how we're conditioned and how that might ripple out beyond the stage and just into our lives. So I get real jazzed up when we get towards that part of the conversation and to hear what other people think about this one and if some of these things resonate. So yeah, here we go. Awesome. Well, we're so excited here at Artist Becoming. We have a dear expander of ours and friend and just absolutely beacon of light in this community that we're very excited to share with this conversation with today. So we're here with Juliana Hazelwood. Juliana is a New York City-based acupuncturist, educator, and somatic therapist. She's a former dancer and artist of many kinds, a creative type like us, whose early career began in the performing arts. And Juliana specializes in helping young adults, teens, and artists feel better in and about their bodies and minds. And Juliana, we are so happy to have you here. To start and to ground this conversation, we would love to start by hearing a bit about your first seedlings as an artist and a little bit about where your journey began. We know that many healers, such as yourself, are deeply rooted in and coming from their own sort of journey as an artist themselves. So we would love to hear about the path that led you to where you are today.
Yeah, I mean, it really started in utero. I often tell people that I am exactly a 50-50 split between my mom and my dad. My brother, totally not. He is a different ratio. I don't even know what the ratio is, but I am equal parts my mom and my dad. But I think in my early life, I was a little bit more skewed dad's side because my dad was a classical orchestra conductor. And my parents met, my dad was from New York City, really. And my mom is Colombian. My dad, on a whim, did like a summer abroad program in Bogota, Colombia, fell in love with the city, stayed there, then fell in love with my mom, who is a biologist studying at a university that had a choir. And she, I think her friends or something dragged her to be in the choir. And so they met, he was the director of the choir and she was in the choir. And so they met in that experience. And, you know, obviously music was this thing that bonded them. And he ended up staying in Colombia for 10 years. They started their marriage there. They started their lives there. And, you know, my dad started his career there. He was the director of the Philharmonic Orchestra in Bogota. Cut to, they moved back to the States. My dad is conducting a lot of orchestras all over the state of Michigan. My mom is getting her PhD in biology, and I'm listening to Mozart like in the womb. And also when I was born, you know, music was just such a strong thread throughout my whole life. And then as I was younger, instead of having babysitters, I would have people at rehearsals sitting around waiting to be part of the opera or the ballet or the orchestra performance that my dad was conducting, and they just sort of look after me. So I really grew up in the wings of arts experiences, whether that was an opera, a ballet. My dad also accompanied ballet classes, so I would, you know, sit and watch the classes a lot. So yeah, I just was sort of born assuming that every competent adult around me or in the world was an artist. It really did not occur to me that other people's parents had different sorts of jobs, and everything in my life was sort of filtered through the experience of a really like classical art, music, dance. My dad was also a big film buff, so he was always watching like the great films. Like I saw The Godfather when I was like 4. I mean, it's really bad when I think about it now, but I was just constantly exposed to that. And then the other side of it, my mom's side of things, was very complementary to that experience, because she, not only was I growing up in a very woodsy, rural part of Northern Michigan, that was exposing me very naturally to the natural world. It was just like, I was as steeped in nature as I was in anything else. She was always egging me on and kind of trying to run experiments with me and just teaching me how to sort of see the world as a scientist. And so as I was growing up, it was like constantly toggling back and forth, or not even toggling, but layering the lens of seeing the world as an artist and a creative, and being steeped in or surrounded by seeing the world through a scientific lens with a fascination for the natural world, my body, other people's bodies, the weather, clouds. I mean, everything, all of that sort of just captured the imagination that was being already really kicked up by all of the art that I was experiencing from a really young age.
Incredible. It's so, it makes so much sense knowing you and knowing how passionate you are about your line of work and this intersection of arts and science, that it is such a deeply rooted orientation of your perception. And I think that there's so many things that we're excited to speak with you about, like in this exact space. So thank you so much for the context around that. So you also have a background as a dancer, correct? Mm-hmm. Can you talk with us a little bit about your relationship to dance and to arts now as it's evolved?
Yeah, well, basically, as soon as I could articulate interest or wants or desires of any kind, I expressed to my parents that I wanted to play music and I wanted to dance. I there was just something about both of those things that was just so admirable. You know, like every cool person in my life did those things. So as soon as they could, they put an instrument in my hand. I started with the violin and eventually played around with a bunch of different things. But from when I was as young as I can remember, I was in a ballet class. And, you know, it's really the most stereotypical kind of ballet love story. I was sitting there watching The Nutcracker, Sleeping Beauty. Coppelia was a big one in my youth. I was just watching the ballets that my dad was conducting. And so it was just the most incredible God, I keep saying inspiring, but it's more than that. It's just like, I wanted to be that. And as a young kid, I just thought like there could be nothing better in the world than to become a ballerina. I mean, it was just like the pinnacle of everything that I could imagine myself being, but always really conflicted with where to put my focus and energy and attention between music, between school, between dance. And so I always felt like I very much was like a jack of all trades, master of none. And so in some ways that kind of set me up to never be like a really great dancer, but a very, very sincere lover of dance, because I got so many different vantage points. And so by the time I got to high school, I was very much like, I don't know what to do. Do I do music? Do I do dance? Do I try something else? Do I write? Do I do visual art? You know, I was just very, very, very confused about which modality was going to be like my thing. And at that point, honestly, I mean, let's be real. If you're 14 and like not that great of a dancer, it's sort of like, it's sort of it. And I had gotten into a freak accident when I was 12, a boating accident. It was so bizarre that really, really messed up the whole right side of my body, but especially my legs, like from literally my big toe to my hip. So I was at a fork in the road where I was really battling my body's natural capacity, a lack of really consistent, good classical training, but like a painful yearning to like be as much of a dancer as possible. Mm-hmm. So at that moment, because it's not interesting what was going on with my injury recovery, but I was consistently not being able to straighten my leg, like not even lift my leg, but straighten my leg beyond maybe like 45 degrees, because I was in so much pain and I had so many limitations in my knee. I really was like, oh shit, like what do I do? How do I mean, I can't do, I'm already not as good as the girls who are coming in to this program. And I realized I didn't even mention what this program was. My dad was the orchestra conductor at Interlochen Arts Academy, which is a performing arts boarding school. And so my whole life, I just kind of assumed that I would go to Interlochen, not really knowing if I would be a dance major or a music major or whatever. But by that time I was just like, oh my God, like I can't even straighten my legs. And all these girls who have been doing summer intensives for their entire lifetime are so much better than me. And da, 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 da. I kind of panicked and I felt what so many dancers feel is like, oh, will this injury just thwart the trajectory of the rest of my life? But on the plus side, I had all this exposure to different types of art and artistry and art making. And I was really genuinely very, very interested in music, in writing, in visual art, in just the composition of art and the art making process. Because yes, I was obsessed with going to see the Nutcracker every year and seeing all the beautiful women or teen girls in tutus and admiring them so much. But I also spent all of that time watching rehearsals and tech and class. And that part really interested me too. So by the time I realized, I don't think I can really dance in a program the way that I would want to, I was also pretty curious and open to other ways of feeling like an artist and being an artist. And at that point, my school, Interlochen, was launching a film program. And it was the first sort of film major program other than a couple schools in California that really existed. So I switched majors and I became a film major. And all my first film was, or my first like thesis project was a documentary about a process that, as looking back, I'm just like, I can't even believe this happened. Martha Graham Dance Company basically did a residency throughout the entire school year because their artistic director, Janet Elber, absolute goddess, was an Interlochen grad. And so she sent a bunch of our faves from the Graham Company to set Diversion of Angels on a group of our dancers at Interlochen. And we did a documentary about that process, about the casting, about the rehearsals, about the performance, all of that kind of thing. And so even though I was not dancing, I still felt as much a part of the process that I loved. And it was such an incredible experience to be like, whoa, not only am I in the parts of the story that I like the most, I'm also getting to direct a team of cinematographers and edit all this amazing footage and put together the pieces of this in an aesthetic way that would not be possible if I were one of the girls on stage dancing. I do think of that as a turning point as far as my identity as an artist, because it just proved to me that you can be an artist in so many different ways. And the more technique and the more exposure you have to different types of art or styles of art or perspectives in art, the more you get to do with that later on in a format that, you know, you probably don't even realize at this moment.
I love what you just said, because it's sort of like perfect little pathway into what I was curious to ask you when you were describing the mom and dad influence and this path that you took and this deep sort of intimate relationship to artistry of many kinds as a young person. And I was thinking about how you now are working at the Joffrey Ballet School in New York City, and you've created and you run their health and wellness department. And I was curious about how, when you're working with young adults, with teens, in a health and wellness setting for dancers, how I was first thinking about how Shelby and I, when creating Artist Becoming, were reconciling that the clinicians or the therapists that we had when we were dancers often felt like a punishment and were frequently someone who really didn't have that intimate connection to art itself. And so that it almost felt hard to connect or to want to absorb the healing that they were offering. And I'm really curious on this sort of unfolding of artistry, how do you bring your artistry into sort of the curriculum that you've developed for the Joffrey Ballet School for these young adults? And how does art play a role in healing? You know, what is art's role? And perhaps particularly in regards to somatics and sort of what's your insight there?
Yeah. Well, in my mind, they are so overlapped. Like the two circles of the Venn diagram are so overlapped that it's just one circle. But I do know that that is not exactly where how everyone's minds naturally maps that out. And I also know from my experience of sort of starting with my self-concept at being an artist and then transitioning into being a clinician and working in healthcare, there are so many things that sort of get picked up by art and then sort of put down by health and medicine. And sometimes people get so wrapped up in the artsy side and the things about art that we love and make us feel good or feel healed or feel better, that just sort of stay up afloat in the air and never really come back down. And sometimes that's okay, but sometimes that's problematic. And what I went through after going to film school and studying dance really, really, really intensely and being, you know, a sensitive, creative kid, was that I got spit out of that experience, not necessarily having been like traumatized by my arts education, but still feeling very raw emotionally and like wanting to understand myself and my body and the world and humanity and psychology and emotions and behavior, but not really feeling like I had tools, like tangible tools to really do that. And that is what led me to alternative medicine, medicine in general. You know, I did what every sort of wellnessy girl does, is I got really into yoga and really into green juice and crystals and tarot cards and whatever. And I'm not knocking any of that necessarily, but it took me a while to find clinicians who I could really trust and give me actual tangible skills that helped me feel better and overcome the health challenges that I had been struggling with my whole life and affected me as an artist. And now kind of on the other side of that whole trajectory and really understanding how the body works, how the nervous system works, how all of these things work, I can recognize that in actually both settings, in arts education settings, in art making experience settings, in art receiving settings, as an audience member, as a listener, as a reader, whatever, there are a lot of things that can go really, really well there that make us feel better, that help us overcome health challenges, whether they're physical or mental. And they can help us build skills that will only serve us in settings that are not directly connected to that art, social emotional learning, relational skills, self-management skills, self-awareness skills, self-regulation skills, all of these kinds of things. But there are also challenging or problematic or risky things that can also happen in those environments that, especially for young people, can pose certain risks or just make it harder to reap the benefits of the good stuff that we all know and love about art that I think needs some intentionality behind them. And that's where the curriculum comes in and the clinicians entering the dance or the art space, I think sort of needs to start happening, because it leaves too many already vulnerable people kind of leaving that experience feeling a little vulnerable. And the dark side of it, there's sort of shadowy side, is that, you know, there can be a lot of teachers or artists who think that really going there emotionally or psychologically is going to get you there from a medical or healing perspective. And that's like the point of it all. And as a clinician, I can see how risky that is, even if it's well-intentioned. And then on the flip side, there are a lot of things in the medical world, in the healthcare world, that, you know, are objectively very helpful. You know, PT can be very helpful if you have an injury. Going to a therapist can be very helpful for an injury. And there are lots of things that we know that are objectively very, very, very good about healthcare. But if you don't maximize the things about healthcare that are also rooted in humanity and creativity and expression and artistry, then you leave a lot on the table there too. And so what the approach that I'm always taking, whether it's like a clinical one-on-one interaction with a student, or, you know, teaching to a group of students, or working with clinicians, or working with teachers, or, you know, whatever combination of variables or representatives of each sort of sector I'm working with, it's always saying, like, what's the best of both of these worlds? And how can we take these two together so that we're protecting ourselves against where these things can kind of go awry and give people a chance to slip through the cracks in a way that we wouldn't want them to? And how can we really allow everyone to reap the benefits of both?
Yeah.
Wow. So incredible. This is like, so my jam, this intersection of science and arts. It's deeply, deeply personal to me as well. And I think that one kind of common thread that I'm seeing throughout your narrative is this idea of this almost like high level orientation of a bunch of variables, right? So for example, that starts from your dad being a composer of an orchestra. It's like all of these musicians, like all these different artists, but like knowing how to guide them in a way that makes it sound synchronous and harmonious, many different personalities, many different tones and instruments and all of these different things. Then you have, you know, your pivot to becoming a film director and being very much in control of the lens and the perspective from which the story is being told. And again, having to like bring together all these different variables of the narrative to get the story you're trying to tell across, right? And then as an incredible writer and a clinician, we follow your work on social media specifically, you know, it's this idea of like who's kind of controlling the narrative when it comes to our mental health. And in artists' worlds, plural, it often is easy to feel very powerless as the ingredient or as the tool, as the artist. And so I would love for you to tell us a little bit about your New Narratives Initiative, which people can read more about on your Instagram, which is bedside.manner, and just chat with us about, you know, how you see the role of being super intentional and even creative and even vulnerable around your narrative can actually work to serve your experience, your perception living in this world of artistry and beyond it, and just chat with us about, you know, the potential that that has to heal and further the art form in a way that is meaningful and sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, as you say that back to me, I'm like, oh yeah, that is, that is what I do. Which is, when you're so in the weeds with yourself, you don't always get that perspective, which is nice to get reflected back to you. And when I reflect back on it, I realize that throughout really all my teens, a lot of my 20s, I had a genuine embarrassment about not being performer necessarily, despite having studied music and dance and film and visual art and theater from literally the time I was born until now, I have never really felt like, quote unquote, a real artist, because I didn't prioritize a performance career and often would find myself in the sort of like synthesize-y, big picture directory kind of role. It's just that I felt like I was in a different category of artist for a long time. But now I'm very thankful for that, because it does give me a perspective on artistry and creativity that I don't think I would have fully appreciated or been as absorbed in if I had been as tunnel visioned as like one type of performer would have been. So I'm grateful for it now, mostly because it does truly define how I approach my clinical work. And I also don't think I could be the clinician that I am without the intrinsic layer of being narrative driven. I can shout out the narrative medicine school at Columbia, which has been super, super formative for me as far as how to weave in narrative to clinical work. But for me, it really boils down to the fact that human beings are narrative driven. Like, we have passed down all of the information that we have to each other through stories from the dawn of time. We learn so much about ourselves and our society from the stories that we choose to tell about ourselves. And that's very much on a macro level, but on a personal level, our personal sense of narrative can absolutely affect the way we feel, the choices that we make about how we're going to behave, what habits we're going to build, the choices that we make about how we're going to take care of our bodies, or what it means to be feeling a certain way in or about our bodies. And in the somatic realm of things, we often work very hard with people to detach story and narrative and meaning from any physical experience or sensation. And what I have found is so powerful with people when they are dealing with some kind of ailment or obstacle or challenge is when you can identify what the storyline is, what the thread is, what your internal sense of meaning behind that story is, and also feel and sense your body in separate ways, then you are able to reconstruct a narrative that feels better, that just simply feels better, that doesn't hurt so much, that doesn't cause you so much strife or grief. And what I love about working with artists is that artists already know how to tell a good story. And that part can, that's like the easy fun part at the end. And sometimes with less creative people or non-artsy people, you know, they can get so literal and logical and rational about the story that it's very hard for them to use imagination as a resource to construct a new narrative for themselves. But with artists, it's like, yeah, they're sold on that part. So it's just getting there, getting to piece apart and identify like what actually is the story that we're working with. And then how does it need to change so that we can feel better about it? So yeah, it's really a matter of playing to an artist's strengths and using that in an intentional therapeutic way with some bumpers around it that are more like clinical in nature, but knowing that anything that makes you a great artist, a great storyteller, can also be used to your benefit if you're working through something that is more medical or health related.
Oh, you're getting me so excited, because this is the juice for me. This is the juice for me. You said something earlier that ties really, really kind of closely to this, which is when you were talking about how so much of our artistry, or how you left your training feeling that sense of rawness. And I think as you're going into this narrative side of things and discussing how artists are such storytellers and how so much of our work literally, it's like a little like scissor or knife cuts down the center of our heart, our body, and opens us up. We peel ourselves open and we tell the story. And there's a lot of emotion, whether it's high ecstasy, joy, or anguish, or the story we're telling, whether we're dancing Romeo and Juliet and pulling all of this intense vulnerability out of ourselves and spilling it out and giving it out to others. And that leaves us just super raw. And even a dance class and being immersed in music and expression and all of that, opens us up, but it really begs the question, like, when you're left open like that, what then is filtering into you? It's very porous. It's a very porous experience. And what are the things following that great opening that are the first things that enter back into you? And depending on the environment you're in, it's quite often not necessarily the nutrients that you really need to receive. And I'm speaking about this from like an energetic lens. I don't have the clinical lens, which is what I'll want you to kind of layer in. But what I find so fascinating is that in my own experience, and I think it's what you're talking to about how dancers or artists of any kind have this sensibility towards narrative. I remember when I was in CATS, I had this like really bad calf injury or something to that regard. And I started going to an acupuncturist that some of the other girls would go see. And I had never been to a therapist before. I had never done talk therapy. I really had never had, and I at this point was probably 25 years old and had never experienced therapy in any type of setting. And this acupuncturist started working on my calf, but very, very quickly kind of dialed into what was a much greater somatic thing, which was so far beyond the calf, but started working a lot in my belly and started doing like hypnotherapy and all these other things started. It turned into body image. And it was like, we were uncovering all these layers that were so far beyond the calf, you know, and carrying that forward, I started working with a hypnotherapist, and then I started guiding hypnotherapy, kind of narrative based meditations, and seeing the power of exactly what you're talking about, which is narrative as a modality to healing. And so I'm curious, how does that come into play when working with young adults? And like, what do we do when artists are left raw and open? How can we use narrative or music or clinical practices to kind of close back up what we have pulled open?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The first thing that I teach my class, my like health 101 class at Joffrey, and really any student who comes to me with anything other than, ouchie, my shin splints hurt, is how the nervous system works. And I call it the three vibes of the nervous system. Vibe one is fight or flight. Vibe two is rest and digest. Vibe three is freeze and please. And, you know, those all have different names, so pick whichever little cutesy saying you prefer. But I really think every person deserves to know what the function of each of these states of the nervous system is and what the signature of them from a felt experience side of things is. Because, you know, you can be in or close to a fight or flight type of vibe your whole day or your whole life and have all of these stories running in your head about, I'm just an anxious person. I really don't do well in big crowds. I have a weird stomach, or, you know, all of the, it's just so easy for the felt experience of your own body to translate into some sort of self-definition or narrative about who you are on a personality level or a temperament level that with just a little bit of knowledge can be recontextualized and understood as, this is just a way my body chooses to protect me because it has felt natural and easiest to access than an alternative. And the alternative being to freeze and please or to rest and digest. So just breaking it down into those three categories of things and giving students the ability to map their own experiences out onto that framework, giving them the opportunity to notice how they feel, and then maybe talk about the meaning and story behind of that. But even just slowing down enough to do the noticing and the scanning and the sensation awareness can sometimes be enough to sort of unraveling that story. I do want to bring some attention and just name the fact that there are things about a sort of classic arts education experience, like the one that I'm steeped in right now and the one that I came from, which is young people whose brains haven't finished developing yet, away from home, away from their sort of original support system, exhausted, going through puberty, nervous about making friends or friend reputation, being asked to do things in front of their peers that may be embarrassing or vulnerable, extra vulnerable, being in the mirror all day as your body is changing. You know, there are just some conditions of the art education experience that already are enough to put people in a sort of nervous system protective response strategy. Like it's already a lot. It's already diminishing a young person's window of capacity for extra spiciness, extra stress, extra stimulus, extra whatever. And so to then ask them to be insanely vulnerable and go to their deepest trauma to unleash it and perform it on stage is a big ask, and that is risky to do. That being said, it's not that people need to be treated like babies, or that we need to be swing into the complete other side of the pendulum and be like so woke that like no one can move, that like everyone is just being so extra careful, because that can also kind of make people feel unsafe. But it has to come from very small baby steps and very small routinely implemented sort of safety parameters or check-ins or opportunities to just sort of zoom out and allow students to experience what they are feeling as human beings first, as nervous systems first, as bodies first, and then figuring out, okay, how do I work with this? What do I need to do to this physical body in order to be this vulnerable or this emotional or this connected or this stimulated or, you know, this exposed in this environment? And so that to me is where the real like systemic work has to happen. The real curriculum design has to happen, because you do need to teach people to take those pauses and do the noticing and slow things down and give students the opportunity to just process what's going on. You know, even if it's not emotionally charged material that they're working with, it's still demanding on their nervous system because of all of those preconditions that put them in a state where they are already vulnerable. And then you also factor in the fact that these are probably sensitive, vulnerable people because they chose to go to art school. Like that this is what we're working with. And so, yeah, it does require, I think, a little bit of extra work, unfortunately, on the teachers who are already completely overworked and underpaid and really taxed, but just a little bit more education around like what is actually happening in the human body in these states of stress. What is actually happening psychologically when we are asking people to connect and be in relation to each other, and what space needs to get created or carved out within what is happening, even though there are a million things happening on at once. And there's always a show that has to get on stage, and it's high stress and high stakes and timelines are short. I think we are at a point just culturally in the arts education world and system that we need to start carving out those spaces and putting in some very intentional, like sort of interventions to just keep people safer.
Wow. This is such a cool and challenging conversation that I have been thinking so much about, because you speak, you know, about this common thing that can happen where we conflate performing our quote trauma, and that might be a strong word for it, what it is, or maybe not, with processing it, right? And so I think about how in any art form or any, you know, super athletic sport or anything, there's so much containment that needs to happen in the technique side of the art. And so you spend so much of your childhood understanding, like orienting your body and your mind to this technique, which is inherently just a containment, like a muscle control and a nervous system suppression. And then, you know, the other very important side of the technique that makes an artist is the artistry component of it. And oftentimes, I mean, in my own experience, I'm like, okay, artistry comes from lived experience, you know, where of course there's that just kind of like physical essence and aura that an artist can have either naturally or it's something that they learn to develop that is very unique to them. But in my own experience of dancing, perhaps more dramatic roles, you know, that is how I felt. I was like, I need to pull from my life experience. And there's even roles that I had been casted to do quite young and thinking to myself, like, I feel like I don't have enough to pull from for this. And then on the flip side, seeing senior ballerinas or Broadway performers or musicians just go at it. And you know that they're pulling from so much. And also more often than not, it's the hard stuff that they're pulling from. And I think that in so many ways that lived experience that's hard and challenging and painful, it does inform some of the richest art. Like, look at the fine artists in, like, you know, the Western and Eastern canons and all of these things. But what we need to kind of shift the lens towards is this idea that, like, just because we're performing it does not mean that we're processing it. And so what wreckage is left after that performance as you go home and ice your feet, you know, or clean your instrument? And so I think your work speaks to that. And it was, you know, the way that you had put it, that conflation of performance with processing, was something that I had never read in such a simple way. It really hit me. So I'd love to just, yeah, pick your brain on that a little bit.
Absolutely. And this is kind of this is what gets me the most riled up in this field that I'm in, because I think it is one of the biggest narratives that we have to dismantle and really reconsider and have respect for as audience members, as teachers, as people who love art that is raw and, you know, really hits where it counts. We have to have respect for the fact that can come at a great cost to artists. And to speak to the clinical sort of technical side of things, the modality that I practice the most is called somatic experiencing. And it's a trauma therapy that is applicable for big T trauma, but also little T trauma and nervous system dysregulation in general. So anything that is, you know, stress based or anxiety based or, you know, dysregulatory behavior based. And the principle behind it is, basically, you experience something, and regardless of what it is that happened, of how quote unquote bad it was, your body reacted to it in a certain way. And your body's number one goal all the time forever is to keep you safe and alive. And it will do whatever it needs to do to get you safe and alive and keep you safe and alive until it decides that it no longer needs to do that, either because the threat has passed, or you got away from the threat, or you fought away the threat. Again, we're going back to the fight or flight, freeze and please situation. So your body and brain, because being alive is so taxing and demands a lot of resources, needs to put as much as possible on the automatic hardware of your nervous system's processing computer, let's say. So as many automatic updates as it can do to keep you safe and alive, it will do, and it will prioritize that so that you don't have to think so hard about just staying alive. And if you've had enough or experiences where you didn't feel safe and your body kicked on fight or flight or kicked on freeze and please, and that seemed to work well enough, it will learn from that and say, oh, that works. That's pretty good. We'll just do that. We'll just do that over and over again. So anytime you feel a little anxious on the subway, or anytime you feel a little like hyped up before a show, we're just going to crank up or crank down the dial and get you in a nervous system vibe that feels like it's going to get you feeling safer, quicker, and easier than anything else. So in a certain way, we have to battle this part of our nature, because of course, I mean, we've all heard this metaphor a million times at this point. Like, our stress physiology is wired to run away from tigers, but we don't live in a world where we're being chased by tigers all the time. So we have to adapt and reconcile that conflict, but also have respect for the fact that our body is still sensing it's unsettled. Like, it's something is unsafe. Something needs to feel more comfortable. So when we're talking about arts environments or the art making process, and we are factoring in all the physiological things that could already make us feel unsafe, whether it's being nervous for the show or being too cold or being too hungry or being fatigued or working with a partner that doesn't always make you feel super safe, or any of these things, we have to recognize that our physiology will take us to a certain place whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
The question then becomes, how do we process the stress that exists in the present moment, in the now, and also have respect for the hardwired stress response that might be connected to an experience that was traumatic and have a big story behind it, but also might not be. It might just be our body's signature vibe. And that's just the hardware that we're working with. And when we're talking about processing versus performing and the conflation that happens between the two, I think the sort of cultural impulse or the encouragement that we get is to just blast through and go like, you know what, just rip it open and just pour it all out and go there and we'll follow. Like this is just what we're doing. From a clinical stress response physiology perspective, that is probably the worst thing you could possibly do, because when you blast through your body's natural stress response strategy, what does that do? It just makes it clamp down and try and get you feeling safer, quicker, faster, in an even bigger way. And so this is, you know, this can look like a lot of things, but frequently what I'll see is like a huge, you know, sort of flare on stage and you are just out of your body and completely free and da, 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 da. And everyone kind of encourages that because that feels like, quote unquote, feels like a big artistic expression. But then you leave the theater and you crash, or you don't even remember what happened, or you feel your energy is actually very, very weird. And like, you feel just kind of agitated instead of like really powerful and grounded and connected to your experience. And it's because you wasted all of these internal resources to keep your body feeling safe, having an experience that is sort of recreating your body's memory of every stressful experience you've ever had ever. Which like is kind of crazy to think about. And it really doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Your nervous system doesn't care. It doesn't know. It doesn't know the difference. It just remembers those three vibes. Heart rate's going up, your heart rate's going down, or your heart rate's kind of chill. And you know, that's happening in every organ level, every, you know, every piece of the puzzle that's working when it's keeping you alive, has kind of a different signature move based on what the stress response strategy is. So yeah, it's why I caution against things that overtly require you to kind of recreate the most challenging experiences of your life, and instead encourage people to find different ways to, again, detach the story from the physiology, from the felt experience, find different ways to assign meaning to it or resolve the story in a different way that are completely separate from the actual physical response. And then you become extremely powerful, because then you can tell the story a million times and it doesn't get a rile out. It's like a song that you were listening to when you were really in love with someone, and then you can't listen to that song like for years. And then all of a sudden you hear it at the bodega or something, and you're like, I actually feel nothing. I don't care. This person means nothing to me. Like that is that you feel powerful in that moment. You're like, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I can engage with this. I can sing along. It doesn't make me feel anything. And that's my goal for all my artists, is that they can live through the experience that caused them whatever is giving them that raw material of their artistry, so that they can approach these big roles or these big pieces with their humanity, not be so afraid of their response, but do it in a way that is like boundaried and contained, professional, and, you know, just sort of separate from their lived experience as a human, but with respect for what is going on. So it doesn't need to be, we baby ourselves. We have to make ourselves so safe all the time. We cannot be challenged ever, ever, ever. Cause that's not going to make good art. That's just going to make like robo people on stage who are afraid to like touch each other. But it, you know, there does have to be a separation at some point. But it's not a divorce where nobody talks to each other ever again. It's just a renegotiation of that relationship between felt experience and story.
I'm having so many like ahas and light bulbs are firing everywhere. Yeah, there's so much there. I think a few things, but one of the first things that I'm metabolizing right now is just thinking about the curriculum of, let's say, of dance itself. And you were touching on this earlier. in regards to how we could intentionally fold in new practices and new touch points. It's all about the nervous system, right? And I'm just thinking about, if we're talking about dancers specifically, and we're talking about, you know, at age 6, 7, 8, you're being put into this curriculum and you are basically getting that is where you're first understanding your body, your nervous system, but under these very traditional classical specific guidelines of a ballet class, a ballet bar, a mirror. And I'm just actually kind of like rewinding the clock and thinking to myself, I was never introduced to the mirror. Like, there are just certain things that when you think about it, no one ever, like, yeah. I just was put into a room with 20 other girls in a leotard and tights in front of a mirror. And then I went on to spend the rest of my formative years and early adulthood in front and surrounded by these mirrors, doing this sort of classical training without much context for the mirror, the reflection. And then on top of it, when we talk about the nervous system, you know, I couldn't agree more about, none of this is about changing technique or the physical requirements or skills to be an elite artist of any kind, but it's about the ballet bar is so tense and so gripped and so tight and so controlled, and you're holding in your tummy as tight as you can, and there's all this tension. And so when we're talking about fight or flight or freeze or please, mm-hmm. that is literally how you are conditioning the wires, your cells, everything about you is being, from a very young age, conditioned to go tighter, to grip more. And then all of a sudden you're like experiencing some great emotional expression, and there's no basically bridge. There's no emotional support or just conditioning that's sort of complementing that very rigid fight or flight. And it's almost like when you go to do a step and it's, you know, tombe, pas de bout, ray, glissade, saut, chat, you're firing. You're just firing, and nothing's like, I'm safe. I'm safe. I'm like, everything is high stakes. Everything is tense. Everything's fired. Everything is physical. And I don't know, your nervous system can't handle the tightness of that container for we're talking decades without this sort of, imagine if laced into that, there was this other sort of somatic experience happening, which is what you're describing. And unfortunately, we are in a sort of historied curriculum in which it's very reactive. That type of layering in that you're talking about, it needs to be layered in, is actually something that is like an ointment that we apply when the wheels have come off. And so how do you prevent the wheels coming off, right? But then I love when you talked about the song reaction, because what I was thinking about was what it builds is nervous systems that are very, very conditioned in fight or flight or freeze and please. And in so many conversations with friends, you know, later in life beyond dance careers, you see relational issues or family dynamic issues or you know, hard at setting boundaries or people pleasing or like this kind of anxious chase in a romantic setting. And I'm weaving those lines together. Like, why do I get into such patterns? And it's like, well, you trained your nervous system to be a fight or flight system, right? And that carries forward. It doesn't go away when you walk away from the stage. It's literally how your body, right, is wired. You're not wired to be soft and open and secure. You're wired to actually, your literal wires are built for fight or flight. So it's just really, really, it's just fascinating. There's no other way to put it. And it really makes you think, how can we not be woke and be like, everybody, let's go roll around on the floor and talk about our feelings and expect to be elite Olympic machines and artists? But it's, where is the intersection, you know, on a daily basis from the beginning?
For sure. And it really does has to happen from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because you're right. I mean, on every level, this is what I also want every one of my students, all dancers, to know this and hear this, because I think it does give us all a little bit of grace for how we've felt and how we've acted in ways that we wish we didn't, because But you have to understand that everything about, especially classic ballet training, but really pretty much all dance training, like physiologically, not just on the nervous system, but biomechanically, puts your body at a disadvantage. Like, we are asking dancers to do something that is extraordinarily taxing and demanding. And because of that, I think dancers deserve extra resources and extra support and extra training and extra interventions and just extra things to help them cope with the fact that this is a extremely demanding and taxing pursuit, whether it's a career or something that you do recreationally. There's no world in which it's going to be an easy time on your brain or your body. And if we're talking about ballet specifically, just on a biomechanical level, the positions that you are asking your body to be in routinely, you're training your body to be in, make it less efficient and harder for your body to breathe efficiently. And if your body cannot breathe efficiently, you will always be stressed. There are ways, way more complicated ways to say that, but at the core, your brain is not going to be having a good time if it's not getting enough oxygen. And so that is also another thing that I teach my dancers as soon as I can, is literally how to breathe better and how to support your intra-abdominal pressure and make that system as seamless and efficient as possible while you are doing ballet things and making ballet shapes with your body, so that your body is less stressed while you're doing your tombé, pas-de-bourre, glissade, saut-de-chat across the floor. Because I bet you anything, you are holding your breath the entire time and saying a little prayer as you lift off the ground, hoping that it's going to be your highest jump. But when I teach you that if you exhale at this point in the jump, as you're releasing air pressure from the inside of your body, literally getting lighter, your jump will get higher and you will feel better when you come down because your brain got more oxygen and the whole process is a little bit more efficient and not so strained and heightened and, forward, forward, forward. And, all of these things. That's kind of like getting into the weeds of it. But, if you just think about how many ballet bars you've done in your entire life and how many times your body has practiced being in a position that makes you feel inherently a little less safe. Multiply that by however many years. Of course you're going to be wound up a little tight. Like, of course you're going to be a little anxious or weird with people when they touch you in a certain way, or when you are stimulated in a certain way. Like, you've been exhausted and deprived of oxygen.
And what it also does is, and this was what I was thinking about, was when you are used to those ecstatic highs and lows, that actually becomes a definition for safety. And so when you move into these other chapters of your life, you seek those like actual safe, calm, secure situations feel dull because you are wired to crave the very high stage light moment followed by the tanking low. And so you actually begin to relate safety to that experience. I mean, the breathing thing. Yeah. Okay. I'll let somebody, Shelby, say something. I'm just having an experience right now.
Well, I will also add hypermobility as another factor in here that kind of makes it all a bit spicier, because your physical body just doesn't feel as much unless it's in an extreme. And we can get really precious about what all of that means, but we also do have to sort of take a step back and say, like, it can't mean nothing, it can't not be considered. So yes, as dancers, we always think my body's my instrument and my body's everything and da, da, da. But I often think that it ends up becoming the sort of situation where our bodies just get sacrificed in the process of our becoming an artist. Yeah. And what I'm always looking at as a clinician is our body's a resource. Our body's telling us everything we need to know. Our body's telling us what it needs to feel safe. Our body is telling us what it feels like to be happy, in pain, overjoyed, excited, anxious. Like, our body tells us everything that we've ever experienced. Everything good or bad has been experienced in our body. Our body is telling us when we've gone too far, when we're not stimulated enough, right? Like, it's all there. The body is the resource, but it's a resource that needs to be cultivated and protected and invested in and sort of related to with a sense of stewardship and not as well, I'll just throw it all in there and see what happens. And I hope the performance is good. And then we'll just do it all over again tomorrow. You know, it's just, I don't know how exactly how we got here that
through several doors.
Yeah. It just boggles my mind that despite the entire art form being dependent on the body, we are so cavalier with it. And then anytime we hit a snag, it's just so easy to blame individuals and write it off to personality flaws or deficits of some kind that are sort of like personal responsibility. And I just don't think that's fair. It's just really not.
I agree. I think, you know, so much of what we're speaking to now is just this comfort and discomfort that a lot of high level artists and athletes and just people that operate in extremes become very acclimated to this nervous system, dramatic high and or dramatic low. And I remember being in school and doing some research on like the pain tolerance of a dancer, for example, and thinking to myself, I feel like we must have a higher pain tolerance, right? Like all we do are painful things. And, you know, what emerged from a lot of the research was just that dancers, athletes, they're just more comfortable in states of discomfort. It's not that they're experiencing the pain any more or less than anyone else is. It's just that this is what's normal. And so you adapt you adapt psychologically, mentally, physiologically in some ways. And then in other ways, you're human. So you can only adapt so much. And then there's just going to be inevitable wreckage, whether that's emotional or physical, to pick up at the end of the day. Jess, what you said about introduction to the mirror reminded me of some work I got introduced to while studying at Columbia University. There's a professor there named Tara Well, and she created this type of mirror-based meditation called a revelation. And she would start every one of our lectures by passing out these mirrors, and we would just sit there and look at our face while she guided a mirror meditation. And I'm just going to tell you, it was deeply, deeply uncomfortable. But I think, you know, so much of what we're doing as technicians and people that are striving for perfection is we're measuring ourselves up against how we perceive ourselves through a mirror or through the eyes of a director or through the eyes of an audience, or even a loved one. And that is just a consistent human challenge across every industry and every lived experience, essentially. But I think that it's so important to consider the tools and the boundaries and the mechanisms that we can have in place to protect ourselves against ourselves. And that is what so much of your work is doing, Juliana, with your students at Joffrey Ballet and as well on Bedside Manner. So as we close, can you just share with our audience how they can follow your work, if there's anything they might be able to look out for or follow to continue learning from you in the ways that you're leveraging arts and science together?
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you. Thank you, first of all, for having me and being so interested in this topic. I often think that I'm like the only, I feel like an island very, very often, just nerding out about all of this in my head. But yeah, I am definitely very accessible on Instagram, mostly because that's where young artists are. And I really encourage my students and artists in general to think about that relationship to that space and that aspect of themselves. You know, it's another part of your persona and your brand and your artistry often. And so I like to make that place as intentionally dedicated to exploring this overlap as possible. And so, yeah, it's the easiest place, I think, to coalesce a lot of these ideas and these people. So yeah, come on Instagram. That's really it. I also do a fair amount of workshops and consulting and things. So if anyone listening is a teacher or a studio owner or anything like that, I'm always looking for sort of education-based experiences to bring some of these ideas to students in a more intimate setting than the entirety of social media. But yeah.
Juliana, thank you so much. I could talk to you forever. You have sparked so much for me. And I think one of the things that I'm taking away from this conversation, from what you've shared, is honestly just the the scanning, like the self inquiry, and just being courageous enough to reflect on the environment that you're in and the conditioning that you're currently receiving and where there might be gaps. And I'm just so grateful for all that you've shared. And I've learned so much from you. And I've learned so much from your Instagram. So it is a hot follow for sure. It is a hot follow.
Well, thank you so much.
Couldn't agree more. And just to shout that out again, so it's bedside.manor, and we'll pop that into the caption as well. But thank you so much for just the gift of your time and the gift of your caring to forward this space and industry in such a meaningful and powerful and actionable way. There's so much potential for growth and expansion. And just thank you for the work that you're doing. It is extraordinary.
Oh, thank you. And truly right back at you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. A couple of ways to keep connected with us at Artists Becoming. First one is here on the podcast. So go ahead and subscribe and write us a review to stay on top of our weekly guest artist conversations. And two, follow along with us on Instagram at Artists Becoming for sneak peeks and inspiring content. DM us if there are dream artists, athletes, performers, psychologists, wellness, whoever it is that you'd love to hear from, or topics that you'd like for us to unpack. We want to invest our time in conversations that enrich you, so let us know. And lastly, share, fire up the group chat, share to your stories, comment, and just stay connected with us. We're here for your becoming.